Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Late last night, House Democrats passed historic health care legislation. The bill reshapes the insurance industry, greatly reduces the numbers of uninsured Americans, and imposes new Medicare taxes on unearned income. Joining me in the studio to talk about the bill, its many political implications, E.J. Dionne. He's Washington Post columnist and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Vin Weber, Republican consultant, former member of Congress representing Minnesota's 2nd District, and Ron Elving. He's Washington editor for NPR. Throughout the hour, I look forward to hearing your reactions to this historic legislation. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can join us on Facebook. You can send us a tweet. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, Diane.
How late were you up last night, E.J. Dionne?
Something like 12:30 or 1 o'clock.
12:30 or 1 o'clock. This was a tremendous victory for President Obama. How big?
It's huge. And to understand how big, you only have to look at what it would have meant if it had lost. He put his entire administration on the line for this. And I think it would have crippled his presidency, or at least dealt it a very, very hard blow that would have been hard to recover from. It would have crippled the Democratic Party. Democrats would have been a laughingstock if they, having put a year 14 months into this effort and had come up short yesterday, I think people would have said, and I think they would have been right, that Democrats are incapable of governing. They have big majorities, and yes, you have all these problems in the Senate, but if they couldn't pass this, I think they would have been in big trouble. And they have really completed, or they didn't complete this, will never be fully completed, as FDR said when he signed Social Security, that it's another step in completing the legacy of Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt, that the biggest hole in our social insurance system has been our failure to cover 40 million Americans with health care, and we're getting very close to covering every American.
Vin Weber, you've said that a vote on this health care legislation would widen the ideological split between people all over the country.
I think that that's true. But before we get into that, and before we argue about this, me and EJ particularly probably, let me say it is a huge victory for the president. There's just no question about that. Whether you support what he did, what the bill had said or not, you got to concede. And I just want to say, I thought really for most of the last year, since the question was not so much was the bill going to ultimately pass when it came to vote. Now, I know after the drama of the last few days, it sounds odd to say that. But I thought for most of the last year, the question was at critical junctures, would the president and the Democratic leadership decide to back away from the bill for political reasons? I thought they could have done that after last August's town meetings when the members of Congress came back having gotten a lot of negative reaction. What did they do? The president went out and held his own town meetings, advancing the cause even further. They might have backed off, obviously, after Scott Brown's election in Massachusetts. What did they do? They doubled down, if you will. And so, you know, you've got to give the president enormous credit. Now, why did I think that that was the big question, was whether or not they'd back off or not, is precisely what your question leads to, Dan. I do think we have polarized the country significantly over the last year, even more than we have over the last 20 years, and that's an issue we could discuss at great length on this program. And I think I think we're headed for an ideological election in the fall of 2010. I'm not dancing in the streets like some Republicans are who think this is assuring us of victory in the fall, but I do think it assures of the kind of election we're going to have, one in which the role and scope and size and expansiveness of government becomes sort of a central philosophical question.
And now, Ron Elving, what happens? Don't the Democrats have something that they can now go out and explain that will perhaps calm the waters rather than divide them.
Prospectively, potentially, and that certainly is a preferable situation to the one that they were facing if the bill had gone down. I agree with EJ in particular when he says this is a great victory because the defeat would have been so much greater than the victory itself. The world of the day after this bill failed is one that the Democrats really did not want to contemplate, except insofar as they did it before in 1994, when the failure to even address the health care issue in the last moment there in the summer and fall of 1994 led to their loss of the House and the Senate. In this particular case, I think the arguments made by the Republicans against this bill throughout the last 13, 14 months would all essentially stand unchallenged if the bill had gone down. It would have, in effect, validated those arguments. If whether they're true or not, they would have been successful, they would have prevailed, and people would have said, well, they considered a government takeover of health care, but it failed. People would have said they considered setting up this, that, and the other, and those things didn't happen because they were so unpopular. We can now see what is in the actual bill. It will play itself out over time, months, years. The country will adjust to it. There will be efforts made to repeal it, efforts made to resist it in the states. But over a long period of time, reality will happen, and we can all respond to whether the health care system is better
or worse. Ron, tell us how last night actually went down.
It was an extraordinarily interesting day in the sense that we began without certainty. The Democrats were saying, we believe we have the votes, but they weren't willing to put a number on it, and they weren't willing to say exactly when they were going to have the votes. And clearly, there were negotiations going on. The most important ones were with Bart Stupak and roughly half a dozen House members who, with Bart Stupak, were still holding out for greater assurance that no money in this bill would go to elective abortions, that nothing would get easier about getting an elective abortion, now prohibited as a use of federal dollars
under the
Hyde Amendment, goes way, way back, and back to the 70s. And this is one of the long-standing agreements in Washington life, and both sides thought that this should be a bill that was abortion neutral. And in the end, some of the activists on both sides saw an opportunity to press and say, we'd like to make things a little more our way. And in the end, they struck what appears to be a neutral bargain. Bart Stupak was willing to accept an executive order to the effect of what he was trying to do with his own language in the bill. And they backed off a further amendment that probably would have been a bill killer in the 11th hour last night. Bart Stupak himself went on the floor and said, this last attempt by the Republicans to send this back to committee on the abortion issue would be nothing more than an effort to kill the bill. I'm satisfied. His bloc came with him, and the bill passed.
And, of course, President Obama had sent an email to news organizations talking about this executive order he was going to draft.
Yes, in the 3 o'clock hour, late in the 3 o'clock hour, suddenly the blast email that goes out from the White House Office of Communication was landing in Blackberries and on iPhones all over this town and many other towns around the world as people were closely watching this. And then within minutes, Bart Stupak at 4 o'clock had that news conference.
I want to get to abortion, but I want to go back to something very important I think that Ron said, which is if this bill hadn't passed, Democrats could not have defended what they had done. They would be stuck with their votes in favor of two different versions of it and would have nothing to show for it. Jay Inslee, a Democrat from Washington State, about a month ago, he lost in 1994 after health care failed the first time. And he spoke to the Democratic caucus and he told me, he said something like this. He said, look, we faced all of this in 94. They called us socialists then. You want to know one thing Americans hate even more than socialists? It's ineffectual socialists. And there's something to that. And I think when people look at this bill, one of the things they're going to realize is that this is in so many ways a moderate Republican bill, not a Democratic bill. The principles in here are market-oriented principles that look very much like what John Chafee was proposing back in 1994. The insurance exchanges, that's an idea that comes from the Heritage Foundation, not a left-wing socialist group, last I checked. And I think there's a very important piece circulating around the web by David Frum, a Republican who worked for President Bush, who says that, you know, Republicans said this was going to be Obama's Waterloo. It may be our Waterloo. And he questions what he called a radical strategy the Republicans pursued and wonders, would Republicans have been better off if they had taken this essentially moderate structure and tried to make it a little more conservative and make a deal? And I think that's going to be, I don't expect most Republicans to take that view on, but I think it raises some real questions about where the Republicans have moved in the last 15 years.
I was going to say, EJ, the alternative to doing this was not doing nothing. The alternative was to do something other than this bill. And the bill that they might have done is some kind of a more conservative compromise, such as you described. The question is, would you have lost so many liberal Democrats in the process that you wouldn't have been able to pass that bill?
Well, that's very possible. But as it is, the Republicans are stuck with simply having opposed it. And what Frum is talking about, if I understand what you know his piece is, you could have tweaked this in certain directions without losing the Democrats. But the point is whether the Frum strategy is right. I think when you talk about this ideological polarization, mm-hmm. I really think you're talking about a Republican Party that has moved steadily to the right in the last 15 years.
Ron, explain the companion bill. What are the specifics?
You're talking about the fixes that the House has preferred.
I think it's hard for us all to understand how this goes forward.
Well, one thing that shouldn't be hard for people to understand, and that is that the House and the Senate are different places. They're different people. They come to office differently. They have very different approaches to the way they pass legislation. And we all know that last December, the Senate had a rather unseemly spectacle of buying votes to get to 60. And they produced a bill that had, among other things, the Cornhusker kickback, the Louisiana Purchase, special deals for individual senators so they would vote for it. Highly unpopular with the public, highly unpopular in the House, and among other things, more substantive things, the House fixes will eliminate some of those unpopular elements of the Senate bill.
Ron Helving of NPR will take just a short break, and when we come back, your calls and comments. And here's our first email on healthcare legislation. Laurel says, and she's in Shelby Township, Michigan, I'm astounded the House went forward with this. Based on several polls I saw, over 50% of the U.S. population is against this. I, Diane, have seen so many different polls. Polls are accurate these days, Ron.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and say I think some polls are probably of greater value than others because I think they are taken strictly for the purpose of ascertaining what the people think, as opposed to for the purpose of moving the debate in a particular direction or electing a certain set of candidates or a particular political party, which a lot of polls have as their ultimate goal. The Gallup poll, sort of the longstanding traditional gold standard, has in its most recent numbers found 48% of the people opposed to the bill as they understood it and 45% in favor. Now, if I'm a proponent of this bill, if I like this bill, I'm not going to be happy with 45%. That's not a great number. But to say that 48 to 45 is overwhelming rejection by the American people, or that the people of America have said no to this bill, is, I think, a a great exaggeration.
That's not quite.
If I were a Democrat, I wouldn't be quite as comforted by those numbers, Ron. Those are national numbers, and you're accurate about that. And there are parts of the country, the Northeast and some parts of the West Coast, where, of course, it's overwhelmingly popular. The problem the Democrats face is if you get into the competitive states and competitive districts that where we're actually contesting elections as opposed to safe seats and safe districts this fall, it's quite different than that. That's where the stronger opposition comes in. And so you look at, that, for instance, Senator Lincoln in Arkansas up for a very tough re-election to the Senate from Arkansas. The number's not 48% there. It's much, much higher in opposition. Mm-hmm. And in most of the battleground seats and states, that is the case.
You know, I agree with Vin that for some Democrats who voted yes yesterday, this is a courageous vote. I don't think there's any doubt about that. However, there was also, by the way, a Wall Street Journal poll that showed a split. I think it was 46-45 in favor. In other words, the country is divided. Two things on this. One, I was very struck with how many of my conservative friends who praised President Bush for surging troops into Iraq against the public opinion polls and said this was a sign of leadership suddenly turned around and said, but on this, everybody should follow the polls. So Vinnie didn't say that as far as I know, but you saw that out there. Secondly, some of the opposition came from people on the left who didn't think the bill was progressive enough. And I think what happened in the last couple of weeks that made a difference is that pretty much the entire progressive movement said, okay, we're not going to get a public option this time. There are other things we're not going to get in this bill. But on balance, from our point of view, this is progress. And they all kicked in to support it. And thirdly, the process was so ugly that I think once you get a bill, I'd be surprised if there aren't a few clicks more in favor of it. Democrats have to sell this bill. If they don't, they got to run this bill as a candidate, basically, for the next couple of months and persuade people we did a good thing.
But in the meantime, aren't there several states poised to say we're not going to adopt this legislation, Vin?
Well, we've got a whole series of challenges that are going to emerge to this bill. The legislative challenges, to be sure, political challenges in the fall. But you've got three or four states where the attorneys general have decided they're going to challenge specifically the individual mandate within the bill, the mandate that people purchase health insurance, saying that that's unconstitutional. I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I have no idea if those challenges have validity. I would guess that the constitutionality of the bill will be upheld. That would just be my guess. But in terms of the atmospherics surrounding this debate, it will contribute to it, and it'll assure that the debate about the bill goes on and on and on for quite a while.
That's right, and I don't think the states are going to have a lot of trouble just saying they're going to opt out from participation in the federal government's program, because that's nullification, and we've been down that road many times.
I thought we settled that under Andrew Jackson.
Abraham Lincoln, exactly. But that's an old one. There is a constitutional issue to be raised, and several people are going to raise it, and it's going to make its way through the federal courts, and we'll see how it works itself out. But going back,
Which constitutional issue are you talking about?
Well, I'm talking about particularly the individual mandate and some of the other things that the attorneys general of the states, including here in Virginia, are going to be raising, and I think those are legitimate questions to ask and have the courts answer. But to go back just for a moment to the popularity issue, people use this expression, the people, quite loosely. The people have decided. I would suggest that whether you're John Lennon singing Power to the People or whether you're talking about the people have rejected this health care bill, it is enormously presumptive to assume that your view speaks for all the people. It's always a question of which people?
Let's talk for a moment about the immediate effects on various aspects, for example, on insurance companies.
Well, first of all, it's very important to understand that this bill takes effect in stages, and it doesn't fully become effective until 2014. And the tax on the so-called Cadillac plans doesn't even kick in until 2018. I saw an excellent chart in one of the papers that really laid out what takes effect first. Some of the taxes don't kick in till later. Also, notably, as far as I can tell, until after this fall's election, which is convenient for the Democrats. The first things that take effect are popular. They are things such as you can't deny children coverage on the grounds of pre-existing condition. That provision doesn't become effective for everybody because you need an insurance mandate first so people don't game the system. Adult children under 27, I guess up to 26, can get on their parents' policies. That's going to save a lot of people a considerable amount of money. No more rescissions. You get sick, the health insurance company says, oh, sorry, you're not covered. Those kinds of provisions are popular. The subsidies and exchanges where people can go in and bargain more effectively for health insurance don't really take effect until 2014.
All right. I want to step back a minute because what I'm still not clear about is what happens next. The president's going to sign this tomorrow, perhaps, or the next day. And then what happens?
Well, just remember, Diane, the very simple constitutional principle that we're coping with here is that the House and the Senate must pass identical bills to be sent to the president. Not similar, but identical. And so the House, in order to get this done, had to pass the Senate bill without any changes at all. That's what they passed yesterday. Now, we know House members, particularly Democrats and Republicans as well, of course, had lots of problems with things in the Senate bill, the special deals made for different states, other provisions in the bills. But in order to get something sent to the president, they had to pass it in identical form. So that's what they did, with the assurance that the Senate will now pass a bill that fixes all of these problems so that members who voted for the bill yesterday, last night in the House, don't have to go and defend all these unacceptable things.
And Senate Leader Harry Reid gave that in assurance, correct?
Right. I mean, he says he's got 52 votes locked up for all of these changes. And a lot of these changes are very popular changes. And the question is, can the Republicans raise parliamentary issues with the Senate parliamentarian and knock out bits and pieces of it, and will they delay? And you know, while they can't filibuster this, the Senate is such a complicated place that you can delay and delay and delay. Could I say one quick thing on procedure and process? I think Nancy Pelosi actually pulled off a real coup against the Republicans. 3 days ago, 4 days ago, on microphones like this, everybody was talking about deem and pass. Remember deem and pass? And she got the Republicans to waste an awful lot of fire on a target that ended up not mattering at all.
Was Demon because Pass, in, bait
with
and switch?
Demon Pass,
was that bait and switch?
She
yeah,
did exactly what made the most sense, which is pass the Senate bill cleanly. You don't want this process to go up to the Supreme Court, especially this Supreme Court. And I think what happened is she used Demon Pass to tell her members, I'm willing to take a lot of heat to make it as easy as possible for you to vote for this. But once she had the vote, she said, OK, we're going to use a very clean process. And there's a lot of ammunition that the Republicans let loose that's sitting sort of uselessly in some corner.
So what will Republicans do now then?
Well, the Republicans have made it very clear they're going to take this issue to the fall campaign. And some people have said we're going to make the fall campaign a referendum on health care. I do not think that that will last as a Republican strategy. If you look at poll, let's go back to polling, and Ron can correct me when I'm wrong about this, but polling for much of the last year has shown a lot of concern, not just about health care, but about borrowing and spending and debts and deficit. The tax issue is rising, particularly in the states where we've seen tax increases over the last year. My judgment is that the health care bill, ultimately for the Republicans, will become part of a much larger message that talks about the expansion of government and taxes and spending. They're not going to ultimately simply try to make it a referendum on repealing this. I even saw, in my view, the most articulate Republican opponent of the bill, Paul Ryan, on the Sunday talk shows, talk not about repeal, but about repeal, reform, and replace. I think that's a pretty important insight. The Republicans understand some of the things EJ talked about a couple of minutes ago are indeed popular. There are reforms that Republicans wanted to see in the health care bill. So they'll talk about getting rid of those taxes that are coming down the road that people don't want to see.
Such as?
The taxes on upper income people, maybe the taxes on the Cadillac plans, even though they're far, far off.
Far, far off.
But, you know, people can get concerned about what's coming down the road, not just what's there. That's why we repealed catastrophic health insurance these many years ago before it ever became law.
All right, let's talk for a minute about the people who currently have their own health insurance and are absolutely satisfied with it. How is this legislation going to affect them, Ron?
it shouldn't affect them directly, immediately at all. But there are going to be those who then have disputes with their insurance company in which they will probably have greater leverage, whether they're talking about a rate increase, a premium increase, a coverage of a particular condition.
We heard some rate increases of as much as 35%.
Well, I believe it was well pointed out in California, went 39% earlier this year, right about the same time that Scott Brown was winning in Massachusetts and making it look as though perhaps all of this was not going to happen because of the loss of 60 votes in the Senate. And it seemed, at times I've thought, if this thing finally does pass, someone could put a label on it and call it the WellPoint health care bill, because right at the moment where the political will to go forward with this was wavering in the White House, wavering in many parts of Congress, out comes WellPoint with a 39% premium increase in California. And Nancy Pelosi, who is from California, said, we're going for it. We're going for the comprehensive bill, and now I think we can get it.
I think Ron's absolutely right. I think that those premium increases, those huge premium increases, restarted the momentum, although I always thought they were going to have to do this one way or the other, but I think those made it much easier. And also, you're probably going to see some premium increases for the rest of the year. The Republicans are going to try to say, see, this is all the fault of Obamacare. I think Obama and the Democrats are helped by the fact that a lot of these increases happened before the bill was passed.
What are the implications of the Medicare tax on unearned income then?
Well, it's a revenue source. If you're a Democrat, you argue this is only simple fairness. You shouldn't tax only people's wages and salaries. You should also tax so-called unearned income. If you're a Republican, as I am, you say this is a direct tax on investment. We're going to take money out of being invested in the economy, and thus is a direct tax on economic growth. I believe that capital gains, dividends, and interests are reinvested to make the economy grow faster. And this is a tax that will slow down future growth.
And this, I think, is how Paul Ryan and others of the Republicans in Congress are seeing this as part of a larger strategy, that they will take it into the larger realm of discussion, which over the last 30 years, really starting with Ronald Reagan's rise, has been won by the Republicans. They have been able to roll back the notion of progressive taxation, roll back the notion that investment money should be taxed the same as earned wages or other income. So this is a debate we're very familiar with. It's one on which the Republicans have had a lot of success over the last three decades, and it's one the Democrats are going to have to gird themselves for, because that's a larger fight the Republicans would like to have.
See, what's interesting is I think they've had a lot of success in terms of pushing these policies through. They're not very popular. And I think one of the reasons the Democrats, I think this is going to be a very important tax change for our whole future discussion of the deficit, because if this stands, and I think it will because it's popular, it hits a very, very, very tiny number of Americans. This increase in applying the Medicare tax to investment income, I think that there is going to be a call for tax reform that says, wait a minute, Warren Buffett said that I am taxed at a lower rate than my receptionist because most of his income is in investment,
gains, right.
Is in capital gains. There's something fundamentally wrong with this, and I think you've breached a barrier here, and I think you're going to see this come back when we talk about balancing the budget.
E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And it's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Let's go first to Susan, who's in Fort Worth, Texas. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Morning.
I am so excited. I'm 66 years old, and I was scared to death I wouldn't live to see this. I'm so excited that it passed. I have a list, a booklet that shows all the senators and the representatives. I found it extremely interesting. I went through. There are 13 Republican representatives in the House, and that are all were against health care reform, and there's four Democrats, and they were for it, not against it.
Are you talking about Texas, ma'am?
No, I'm talking about our U.S. I think if you'll get in there and count them, there's 13 Republican doctors in the House.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you.
And there's four Democrat doctors. I'm sorry, I may not have said doctors.
Yeah, okay. So your point being?
No, there's no There's no doctors in the Senate that are Democratic. I think there's four that are against health care reform that are Republican. You know, I just find that fascinating.
All right, to Vin Weber.
Well, that's true. The Republican physicians in the Congress were deeply opposed to this throughout because they believe that it's going to interfere in the doctor-patient relationship. And the Democrat comeback to that is, well, the insurance companies are already interfering in the doctor-patient relationship. So you've got that's another debate that we're going to carry on through the fall.
No, and Vin is right. And I think one of the reasons we got health care reform is once upon a time, back when we passed Medicare, the physicians were united against this as socialized medicine, and they were terribly worried about it. Then they had a whole lot of experience with managed care and private insurance companies, and now physicians are essentially split on this. I think the people who are really worried about it are the very, very highly compensated parts of the profession, certain kinds of surgeons. I doubt many orthopedic doctors are wild about this, and that there are a lot of other doctors, emergency room docs and others who are at the lower end of doctor compensation, who are sympathetic to insurance reform.
And the American Medical Association signed off on the latest version of the bill, as did the nurses.
Isn't that interesting?
And it is terrible. I mean, it's surprising to anyone who has watched these debates back over the last several decades or who has doctors in their families to see just how much it has changed.
Ron Elving, he's Washington editor for NPR. More of your calls when we return. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by American University, by the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day at wallacefoundation.org, by the Avis Family Foundation, supporting expanded foreign news online and on air, and by the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.
An internationally acclaimed animal behaviorist on the human-canine relationship, Patricia McConnell offers perspectives on training a puppy and the role of pets in children's lives. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And here's an email from Bob, who says, I understand most but not all Americans will have access to health care insurance. I know illegal aliens and prisoners are excluded. Are there other categories excluded? Will people here on travel visas have access? What's the rationale for cutting $40 billion of Medicare health care? EJ.
Well, the main exclusions are for immigrant groups. The total number of insured is probably also going to be reduced a little bit because not everybody is going to buy it. Even with a mandate, they have ways around it. They'll have to pay a penalty. And so that's another sort of percentage or so off the final number. And the debate on Medicare is going to be part of this this campaign. Democrats argue that the cuts they made are in Medicare Advantage, where they say, and I think they're right about this, Vin, I'm sure disagrees, that is really a subsidy to a privileged group, and it's really a subsidy to insurance companies. The insurance companies make money by being reimbursed at a higher rate for Medicare Advantage people than for the 80% of people on Medicare end up paying into the system. Could I say one quick thing? I mentioned orthopedic doctors. Unfortunately, our family has spent a lot of time with them lately, and I love them all, whatever their politics are. They've been very good.
Just to say about the Medicare Advantage and the issue of cutting $400 billion out of the cost of Medicare over just this next 10 years, this is one of the most rational arguments against this bill and its entire funding structure that the opponents, I think, have raised. They have raised many other arguments that may not stand up as well, take the test of history. But we do know this over past years when people have said we're going to cut back on payments to hospitals and doctors. Really, really, we will. And that's where the savings will come. It hasn't happened. And so there's going to have to be a new spine in the Congress to make some of these cuts actually take place if they are going to have the positive effect on the long-term deficit that the CBO says the bill will have.
I think this is a very central issue, Diane. This is why I've said throughout this program the Republicans are going to morph this into a part of a larger issue. I don't think Republicans are going to necessarily want to debate health care narrowly defined from now until November. But what Ron said, I think, is absolutely right. I don't believe for a second that the CBO's numbers are going to hold. I do not believe for a second that Congress is going to cut $400 billion out of Medicare. I don't believe that they're not going to do the doctor fix that's coming up probably within the next few months. So you're talking, in my judgment, I think Republicans will make this case, that you're talking not about a deficit neutral or reducing bill, but something that's going to add as much as $500 billion to the deficit over the next 10 years.
Could I say quickly on that, the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, yes, a progressive group, but I think everybody respects their numbers. Just the fact is that if you go back and look at reductions in Medicare that the Congress has enacted over a long period of time, Republicans and Democrats in the majority, most of those have stuck. So I think that when you look at this and say they're all going to disappear, there are no savings here, I think that's wrong. And the CBO didn't underestimate the cost of the Medicare prescription drug benefit. They overestimated the cost. So the estimates can go either way.
Do you think we're going to reduce reimbursement to physicians by 21%?
No, they're going to fix the reimbursement to physicians.
Well, that's $200 billion.
Right, but I still think that when you look at the reductions in this bill plus the tax increases, I mean, we've passed a bill where Congress was willing to raise taxes to pay for it. That's very different from the tax cut and spend policies we had for a long time.
All right, now here's the question. You all are still debating elements of this when, in fact, the American people maybe want to move forward. Talk about other things. Are we going to be able to do that?
Oh, absolutely. I think, first of all, I thought it was very striking that when President Obama gave his Saturday radio address, he didn't talk about the health care bill. He talked about financial reform. He wants to move ahead. I mean, we will obviously be talking about this bill for a long time because it's hugely important and it will be part of the debate. But as Vin suggested, this election will be about jobs. It'll be about how we fix a broken financial system. So we will not be obsessed with this. And Obama's the first person, I think, who doesn't want us to become obsessed with this.
Let's go to Ponce Inlet, Florida. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning, Diane. First of all, I'm amused when Republicans threaten Democrats over this bill. After 8 horrific years of Bush and Republican governing, nothing they do could scare me now. But my question is, 32 states, including Florida, want to sue the federal government over the mandate clause. I understand the mandate doesn't go into effect until 4 years from now, and legally, Republicans really can't do anything until 2014. So aren't these lawsuit threats just political posturing?
I don't know. The law has passed. The fact that all provisions of it haven't taken effect doesn't mean you can't challenge provisions which down the road may take effect, but I'm not a constitutional lawyer. I don't know the answer to that.
Here's a question from Greg, who says, could you comment on the closing of the donut hole and what that means for seniors? Ron?
At the current time, the Medicare Part D, which was passed back in 2003 by a Republican Congress and George W. Bush, which provides prescription care, prescription drugs for seniors, cuts out at something like $2,750. That's where I was running into the problem. $2,750 in coverage, and does not kick back in until the individual has over $6,000 in prescription drug costs. In between, there's what's called the donut, and there's no coverage. One of the first things that kicks in this bill and becomes effective in the first year is a $250 refund for people in that situation. And over time, the bill addresses that donut entirely.
And this was a political response to the success Republicans had to some degree, partly because seniors are a more conservative group, in casting this bill as bad for seniors. And the Democrats can come back and say, wait a minute, this thing in the Republican prescription drug bill that really annoyed you, we are in the process of fixing. And so I think for a lot of individuals, that's going to be important protection. But politically, it's important protection for the Democrats.
Here's an email, caller in Raleigh, North Carolina. Good morning, Roger.
Yes, good morning. It's well documented that union, public sector, and some corporate pension plans are in serious trouble, and I can't see that some of their health care allocations is not going to be taken off the table and put into the pension plans now that we have options.
What do you think, Ron?
Certainly, it's true that many pension plans in various parts of the economy, whether they're union plans, company plans, public sector plans, cities, counties, many of which have granted very generous benefits in the pension area, are in trouble because their investments have not done very well. They've been subject to the exact same vagaries of the market the rest of us have been subject to, well-documented several years of bad returns. So a lot of people are flailing around and looking for places where they can come up with money, and they're probably going to look at how this health care bill affects the choices they make. How exactly that plays out, I think it's early to speculate.
Here's another question from some seniors who say they paid into Medicare. They're retired. They paid into Medicare all their lives. They go on to say, we did not include a Medicare tax on our investment income in our retirement plans. Now we find the government will tax the earnings on our investment. This is unfair to seniors who've worked hard and saved all our lives to provide our own income.
Well, I suppose this is destined to be an argument between EJ and me, but I certainly agree with that point of view. Now, the Democrats will argue, but it doesn't kick in till a couple hundred thousand dollars of income. But, you know, for the seniors you're talking about, they probably worked their whole lives to get to the point that that's how much retirement income they have. And they've got a lifestyle that most people wouldn't consider opulent based on that, and now it's going to be taxed away from them. And I think that there will be a group of people very angry about it. And I also believe the macroeconomic consequences will not be good, as we talked about a few minutes ago. It's a tax on investment against growth.
I disagree with that, but I think politically, look at this. A senior citizen who earns more than $200,000 a year is very, very likely a Republican and would not have voted Democratic under any circumstances. And I think the real key, there's about a 20% swing in the senior citizen vote. And I think that Obama didn't get these seniors in the last election. It was his weakest group in the electorate. The key is whether Democrats can persuade this middle group of seniors, this floating group, that there's more good than bad for them in the bill. And very few of those are ever going to pay any of these taxes because their incomes aren't that high.
All right, to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Jill, you're on the air.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say it seems to me that only the privileged have doctor-patient relationships to damage, because the rest of us have no doctor-patient relationship because we have no health care. And I'm a single mom with chronic health issues and no health care for myself or my daughter. And I want to know when this is going to benefit me and how.
When and how, Ron?
Without being able to speak to the individual case of the caller and where she is attempting to get care now. It sounds as if she may be a candidate for Medicaid, which is a cooperative program between the federal government and the states. This bill will be making some changes in Medicaid, all of which are intended, all of which are aimed at making it more possible for people to get care no matter what their conditions and to get care without having to pauperize themselves first. It would be, I think, a true setback to the intention of this bill if this particular caller were not a beneficiary.
And I think in the short run, there is a provision in this bill, which, by the way, is partly modeled on an idea John McCain had to create while we're waiting for the whole system to take effect. There's a fund to help people with pre-existing conditions get some coverage in the interim, and I think that's an important component of the bill.
All right. To Lebanon, Illinois. Sandra, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just had a kind of a comment. What bothers me is every time Congress tries to fix something, they come up with these big behemoth bills. If a year ago somebody had just come up with a single-issue bill, for instance, for no pre-existing conditions can be used to deny you insurance, okay? Everybody would have probably voted yes, and then they would have had one thing fixed. If they had done this as smaller bills, fixing first the things that everybody seems to agree on, then at least we would have had half of it fixed before they started arguing about the stuff that nobody agrees on.
It would be easier to do it that way. The problem is that the healthcare system has a lot of moving pieces. If the only thing you did was to, without a mandate or anything else, just say insurance companies can't discriminate against pre-existing people with pre-existing conditions, two things would happen. One, you'd have people who could game the system not start buying insurance until they got sick, and that would have the second effect of jacking up premiums for everyone else. The reason the healthcare bills are complicated is because the healthcare system is very complicated, and if you fix one thing at this end, you got to make some adjustment at the other end, and that's why the bill is really thick.
E.J. Dionne. He's with the Washington Post and the Brookings Institution. You're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And the question becomes, what are the risks for President Obama? Is he likely to become a one-term president because of this bill? Vint Weber.
Well, first of all, we don't know for sure. Let's just say that the risks, to the extent that they exist for Democrats, are far, far more focused on Democrats in the Congress than they are on President Obama. We're going to have time to see if this bill is popular after it's implemented, not fully, but more than by this fall, when President Obama runs for re-election in 2012. So the risks to the president are considerably less than the risks to those Democrats in Congress who are going to have to go back not in 2 or 3 years, but in right now, and defend this bill in the context of all the other spending and taxing decisions that are being made around them to an angry electorate out there.
In the next 2.5 years, the president can be expected to make a myriad of decisions on foreign policy, perhaps on war and peace, on financial re-regulation, on a host of issues affecting the budget, a host of issues affecting people's personal wallets. And on all of those issues taken together, people will judge him, and then they'll make the final judgment, which our binary party system forces them to make. Do I like Obama, or do I like the opponent that the Republicans have put up against Obama? And that'll be the ultimate decision. The health care bill will be part of that mix. It's not likely to be the only thing or the salient thing.
And I won't take too much time, Dan, but we've been talking solely about health care. That's understandable. Let's remember the world has a way of changing American politics
very
and world
quickly.
Politics. And there are lots of issues out there, even in the next few months, to say nothing of the next few years, Iran, Afghanistan, the Middle East. All of these issues could upset the apple cart and give us a whole different agenda to be debating, both in 2010 and certainly in 2012.
I want to go back to something Vin said at the very beginning of the show, precisely because this will be perceived by everyone from left to right as an enormous victory for President Obama. This helps him far, far more than it hurts him. He comes out of this with some momentum. He can go into new issues. Finally, this long debate is over. So it's way too early to talk about 2012, but he's far better to have this than not have it.
Jobs, Will jobs be next, or immigration next? What's next?
Financial reform is probably next. Fixing the Citizens United case, one of my hobby horses, is going to be out there. Immigration reform is very difficult. That actually will only happen if we can find a moment of bipartisanship, and it'll be a very interesting pivot from this fight to that argument.
What's the potential there, Vin?
Let me answer a different question.
Okay.
The polls clearly show that jobs is what people are concerned about, and the Democrats want to, quote, pivot and talk about jobs. The difficulty is we don't have many policy levers left to pull to help spur job creation. We already did a huge stimulus package a year ago. The Federal Reserve, which probably has more influence over this than anything else, has done about as much as they can in terms of monetary stimulus. So Democrats who now want to talk about jobs really can't do much other than talk about them, because there's not many policies left to implement.
Except last week we did have the Senate clear for the president's signature a $17 billion jobs bill, which was a hybrid of government spending through the private sector to try to create some more jobs. How many it will eventually create, we'll not know for a long time. But I suspect there'll be more bills like that between now and November
to do the jobs. That's more window dressing than I don't want to sound like $17 billion is not a lot of money, but the stimulus that we passed over a year ago was $800 billion. And many Democrats said at the time that that was inadequate. Some Democrats, like Paul Krugman, still say that was inadequate.
It was inadequate.
So a $17 billion bill, by the Democrats' logic, isn't much.
The point is to keep passing bills that say jobs.
And so clearly these discussions are going to continue. Ron Elving, Vin Weber, E.J. Dionne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information.